Hello, Roy here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to The Roy Green Show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Welcome to The Roy Green Show podcast.
Trudeau and Mr. Guilbeault are going to see to it that tomorrow we're going to see the increase in the carbon tax. And when you drive by a gas station sometime tomorrow, and if maybe you filled up before Monday, before tomorrow, you'll have a look at the board. I know, we'll all do that. We will all instinctively look at the board to see how much the price is. And I can tell you, you won't be happy. So the apologists have all started trotting out their excuses about why the carbon tax is actually not a bad thing or a good thing. We knew that was coming. I've done my very best to ignore that messaging, because the truth of the matter is the Canadians are finally standing up, finally saying about things that they've had enough with. I've had enough with this. I don't want to hear you tell me how happy I should be about circumstance A, B, or C. I'll make up my own mind. I only hope that we continue to do this and in a more sustained manner. We're going to have lots. Yeah, we'll have lots to share about the carbon tax tomorrow on today's program. And we're going to get started right now. You just heard the voice of Premier Scott Moe of Saskatchewan, who was with us yesterday starting the program. And three premiers appeared before the Federal Government Operations and Estimates Committee this past week to make the case for the delay of the federal carbon tax increase, or preferably abandoning the carbon tax entirely. So I also had the opportunity yesterday, just before we went on the air, to record an interview with Alberta Premier Danielle Smith, who was also one of those three premiers, as was Blaine Higgs of New Brunswick. So I want you to have a listen, please, if you will, to what Premier Smith had to say to us about the carbon tax and a few other things. Have a listen. Premier, in your video appearance before a parliamentary committee on Thursday, you described the carbon tax increase, which is taking place tomorrow, to be not just reckless, but immoral. I don't know that too many people who listen to this program would disagree with you, but would you please, for my listeners, all of them, make that case?
Well, sure. I mean, when I look at the carbon tax and how it's applied, you have to remember it applies to two things. On the one hand, it applies to gasoline and diesel. And when you pay $1.50 in gasoline, you're paying about 35 cents of combined federal taxes for their fuel tax, for GST, as well as what will be 17 cents of carbon tax. And I think most people understand, they're trying to make it otherwise, but most people understand that the rebate does not fully compensate for the cost that they're charging. In fact, in Alberta, the people are going to pay $911 more in the taxes than they get back in the rebate. So that's one side of it. But the other side, which has me really concerned, is the tax on natural gas. So natural gas right now is about $1.72 a gigajoule. So people should be able to enjoy heating their homes at a very low rate right now. But the federal carbon tax is going to go up to $4.09 a gigajoule. So you're going to be paying more than double the amount in the tax than you do for the base fuel. And when you look at our cold country, December, January, February, March, and often April, when you have to turn on the furnace and keep your lights on, and in Alberta, our lights are mostly powered by natural gas, it's outrageous that we would be taxing people on that basic necessity of life. That's why I said it's immoral and they should stop it.
And the Parliamentary Budget Officer has on several occasions on our program said, quite frankly, look, the carbon tax will assist those who are at the lowest socioeconomic level, but for anybody in the middle class, it is going to be a net loss once they get to the 2030 maximum. So Mr. Trudeau going forward and saying that's not the case, in fact, saying that Conservative premiers are lying about the carbon tax, that's a mouthful. What do you say to Mr. Trudeau's remark?
Well, it's either are putting the carbon tax in place to reduce emissions, or they're doing it for redistribution purposes. And they keep trying to argue both. I mean, I'm not quite sure I understand. And I said this to the committee. What do they think happens when they give $200 or $300 to a family? Do they think they take that money and go out and buy an electric car? which costs $60,000? Do they think they go and change out their fuel system to from natural gas to geothermal or something else, which can cost as much as $10,000 to $20,000? I'm not quite sure what they think the tax is doing to change behavior, because when consumers don't have a feasible option to be able to switch to another type of fuel, all it is punitive. All it is it's causing them more hardship and making life more difficult when they can least afford it in the middle of winter. So I far prefer the approach that we want to take in Alberta, which is to end the retail carbon tax and work on the technology improvements. Because at the moment, you just can't get an electric car in Alberta. We only have 2,000 or so a year that are purchased out of 200,000 that are sold. And part of it is there's a long waiting list for it. So why are you punishing people when there really isn't an ability for them to switch to a zero emissions vehicle? Same with home heating. What we're working on is injecting hydrogen into the natural gas stream to lower the emissions profile. That is really early on. We're just beginning that work. So why are we punishing consumers in the meantime while we're trying to sort out what the technology is and what the infrastructure needs to be to make that work? It doesn't make any sense. And I think most people are seeing it, they're saying it, and they're feeling it. And I wish that the federal government would respond.
We're harming our entire economy. We're harming our treasury. We're $1 trillion in national debt. And last week, we had the Greek prime minister in this country looking for a LNG export deal. He was sent home, as were the chancellor of Germany and the prime minister of Japan earlier. Did you at the parliamentary committee meeting let them know? Was it necessary to make the case for LNG exports from this country to a world in need of liquid natural gas and our national budgetary reality, which would be perfectly served if we were taking in billions of dollars in LNG sales?
Well, I shouldn't have had to tell them, but
no,
I did.
Shouldn't.
I told them to go and read the COP28 agreement that we signed on to. It clearly defines natural gas as a transition fuel. Now, we look at it as a transition fuel and a destination fuel, because we know it can be used for all kinds of useful things. In our province, for instance, we're using our natural gas, taking out the CO2 and turning it into petrochemicals with Dow Chemical's Net Zero Petrochemical Project. In Heidelberg is going to be taking the CO2, embedding it into cement and turning it into net zero cement. You've got Air Products, which is taking the CO2, burying the CO2 and turning it into hydrogen. And we're going to see more and more of those types of innovations. I know Japan and South Korea and India are all interested in taking ammonia, which is again the CO2 stripped out and nitrogen put in, so that they can add it to the stream for doing dual combustion on coal so that they can reduce emissions. We also know a part of the reason why jurisdictions like Alberta and many in the United States have seen a decrease in their emissions is because we've switched away from coal fire burning of electricity to natural gas. So for the federal government to be punitive about natural gas and not understand its role in being a carrier of hydrogen, which is ultimately fueling the economy of the future, it's self-defeating. And I don't think it lives up to the commitment that we signed when we signed on to the latest that came out of COP28.
No, I look out the window here at CHML in Hamilton, and I see city buses going by, so public transit, proudly displaying a sign that reads "powered by natural gas." So it just does not make any sense. What about Stephen Gilbo? What's his reaction to the declaration at COP28 that LNG is a transition fuel?
I think he's ignored that part. I mean, part of the problem I have with Environment Minister Stephen Gilbo is he's an ideologue who has always felt like there's only one way to achieve the target. It's why they aren't changing the channel or turning the corner on carbon taxes, even though he has acknowledged himself that they're not going to work until 2060. He also has this, and the extreme environmentalists do, they have this idea that the entire world can run on wind and solar and batteries. And we just showed in January that is absolutely not possible. The reason we can expand wind and solar is because we have natural gas as peaker plants as backup. So I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding about the role natural gas can play, not only for transportation, like you just described, whether it's in natural gas form or hydrogen form. We just launched our first hydrogen fueling station in Alberta in this past week. We've got hydrogen buses that are being tested on the road right now. We've got a dual fuel vehicle for long haul vehicles that are using hydrogen in their stream. But I think he doesn't understand all of the ways in which natural gas are going to fuel that energy future. I think that the attitude of the extreme environmentalists is they just hate fossil fuels. It's not about the emissions. It's about ending fossil fuel use. And that's not on in Alberta. We are going to reduce emissions. We are not phasing out production of oil and natural gas. And in fact, I wish the federal government would live up to its commitment, because our partners need us, especially with the conflict with Russia invading Ukraine. Our partners would do well to have a safe, secure supplier of this vital product from us rather than their enemies.
Well, your internal partners and your internal suppliers, Alberta business executives from the energy and broader sector, wrote an open letter to the federal environment minister earlier in the week, as you know, challenging his oil and gas emissions cap and reminding that Alberta is the only oil-producing jurisdiction, as I understand it, in the world facing a federal emissions cap, instead of, like others globally, working on driving investment into oil-producing and export projects. He's just not going to see any value in that letter, I suspect.
The problem is that we're all in agreement on getting to neutrality by 2050. And neutrality means a lot of different things. In our province, what it means for the oil and gas sector is abating emissions, which we've done successfully on methane. We've reduced emissions 45%. We're going to do better on that. But it also means capturing the CO2 and burying it, carbon capture utilization and storage technology. We've already developed that at scale. That's one of the major proposals of our oil producers. There's also small modular nuclear, and we already have Capital Power, which is one of our major generators, talking to Ontario Power about being able to adopt nuclear to decarbonize their production. So that I'm told is going to be, unfortunately, a 10-year process. Maybe we should work on trying to accelerate that process. And then there's also direct air capture. We funded a number of projects that one of which has demonstrated its value. It was purchased by Occidental Petroleum. They're rolling out 300 sites where you can capture the CO2 directly from the air. I'm reading in Australia, they're doing the same thing, building a commercial project where you can capture the CO2, add magnesium and calcium, and turn it into a building material. We are going to have more and more of those kinds of projects. And so that's the reason why we need to be focused on emissions overall and the various ways that we're going to reduce them, as opposed to trying to put in arbitrary caps with an unrealistic time frame. If you do that, it's essentially a production cap. And we've seen reports that suggest that it would reduce our production by as much as 1.2 million barrels a day. We're just not going to let that happen. We have the right under the Constitution to develop our resources, get them to market. And as long as we're achieving the emissions reduction targets that we signed on to, we are not working at odds with the federal government. The federal government is just working at odds with us.
Mm-hmm. Premier, Alberta's fuel rebate ends tomorrow and increases the cost of a liter of gasoline by 4 cents. I've heard from Alberta listeners who support you, but they also say that your argument against the additional carbon tax is weakened by your government's decision to end the rebate tomorrow.
Well, look, I understand that nobody likes to pay taxes. I get that. But we also have roads to build. And we've got a $2 billion transportation projects that we need to make sure that we're funding. When oil and gas prices, or when oil is low, WTI is low, we just don't have the windfall revenues to pay for that. And so I don't want to have to reduce the amount that we spend on roads and building bridges. And I want to run a balanced budget. The difference in our program is that when oil goes high, when it goes above 90, we'll be taking the tax off again. And that's the deal that we made with Albertans, is that program would be permanent. But we haven't seen the stability in the prices at the moment. And so we have to make sure that we're funding our capital projects. What I would say is that it's unreasonable to expect that we're going to take a sacrifice, reduce our road budget, so that the federal government can play this Ponzi game that they're playing with carbon taxes, virtue signaling, as if it's going to do something meaningful when it's really not. What the federal government has 35 cents of a liter of gas is their various taxes. Ours is 13 cents and it's going to go to road construction. So I hope people understand that, that this is the compromise that has to be made. The federal government cannot just keep on taxing because it then impairs the province's ability to pay for the things that we need to pay for, that our ratepayers are asking us to pay for.
Premier Smith, thank you very much for the time. People will hurt tomorrow when they have to pay that additional carbon tax. And I said earlier, when inflation was the issue, inflation really is when people go to the gas station or the grocery store on the same morning and cannot afford to fill up at either.
And the other part, too, is people need to remember that they're paying more than double the cost of natural gas when they heat their home. That is the tax that is absolutely outrageous. It's not applied fairly across the country. They've given a special reprieve for Atlantic Canada on heating oil. Quebec was bragging that they don't have retail carbon taxes. And so that's not fair. That's creating a national unity crisis. And that's one that they really have to take off completely. And also be looking at ways of making sure that we have a different approach for reducing emissions. This one is just hurting people, and it's not fair.
Premier, thank you for the time, and happy Easter.
You bet. Thanks, Roy.
I always, enjoy this when they say, well, why won't you put a plan forward? And that's what we hear from the Prime Minister all of the time, is why won't these Conservative premiers and the one Liberal that he forgets about put a plan forward? Well, many people that get behind that argument, many of them in the media world, they've been sipping from the royal chalice for just a little too long. What the Prime Minister means by that is put a plan forward like his. So put your own carbon tax forward and then he will remove his. Well, the problem isn't who's charging the carbon tax. The problem is that it's there in the first place. It isn't working to reduce emissions. It's costly for families. It's costly for business. It's upsetting our investment environment as identified by the Bank of Canada.
A lot of the politicians have been sipping from the golden chalice far too long. Well, they're going to be sipping from the golden chalice even more tomorrow because their salaries are going up. The base salary for a member of parliament is going to be $203,000 and change. Now, if you're a cabinet minister, you get an additional $96,000. So you're right around $200,000. And if you're an opposition leader, you'll get more than that. If you're a committee chair, and there's so many of them, they get a lot of money too. And the Prime Minister, Mr. Trudeau's salary, will reach $403,000 a year. We'll get more on this later on the program today. Now, we've talked a lot about the Bank of Canada on this program and in this country, particularly over the last 2 years. I can't recall a time where we spent as much time talking about the Bank of Canada. And it's had to do with the inflation and the interest rates, and we were held in total suspense as to what the Bank of Canada was going to be doing next. We know that 40% of us, 40% of Canadians have difficulty sleeping at night thinking about their financial well-being. And that was from last year's RBC Financial Well-Being Survey, 40%. And if you look at millennials aged 27 to 42, the number losing sleep jumps from 40% to 53%. These are not great times. And then, I know you've been paying attention to this, we've talked about it, the senior deputy governor of the Bank of Canada, Carolyn Rogers, last Tuesday said, "You've seen those signs that say, in case of emergency, break glass. Well, it's time to break the glass." Let's talk about where we are, what's happening as far as the Bank of Canada is concerned, what we can expect. Our great friend, Dr. Eric Kam, macroeconomics professor at Toronto Metropolitan University, is back with us. Dr. Kam, how are you?
Roy, I'm doing well, and a happy, healthy Easter to you and all of the listeners.
Well, happy, healthy, I can say it, Easter to you as well, Passover. And we had a new name for it, though. Veterans Affairs Canada called it something else, the March season. I have to look that up because it's just so annoying. Okay, let's get at the Bank of Canada from this perspective. We have the senior deputy governor saying, "You've seen those signs that say, in the case of emergency, break glass." Well, it's time to break the glass. We're in a national emergency situation. What is she, in layman's terms, Dr. Kam, telling us?
Well, I'm going to tell you what she's saying in layman's terms, and you're not going to like it, but it's consistent with the theme over the last couple of years. How many times have you and I discussed when the bank or other public sector institutions, Roy, say, don't look over here, look over here. So this is just another case for me of the Bank of Canada telling the economies, and I say that because I'm using the different provincial economies because they're all a little bit different, that we've got some rough waters ahead. For those people in Ontario, they saw the most recent budget given by the Conservative government. Parenthetically, it was the least conservative budget I've ever seen in my entire life, but we can get back to that. I think what Ms. Rogers is doing is she's saying, in a sense, the demand side of our economy that you and I have been discussing for years, the demand side, interest rates, spending, government spending, consumption, we're losing the battle. We're not gaining anywhere. There are not less people losing sleep. GDP is not rising like it should. So what should we do? Well, Ms. Rogers says, get off of the demand side that the bank can actually control. Let's look at the supply side, Roy. Let's look at the supply side of the economy, which we can't control. So I can say, there's your problem. There's what we have to target. But don't call me because I do demand management. Call the supply side people, Roy. But don't get it mixed up, Ms. Rogers says. Don't call my extension. That's not my office.
She's doing us a service by saying what she said. She's requiring people to pay attention, and we've talked about this. The OECD says Canada will, for the next 36 years until 2060, be the laggard and post the worst economic performance among advanced nations as far as real per capita GDP is concerned. That's something that should worry us as well. So if we can go, this is the supply side I think I'm talking about now. The Greek Prime Minister was here last week. What was he looking for, Professor Cam? He was looking for Canadian exports of LNG to his country, which could then act as a hub for further distribution to our European allies. He was sent home empty-handed, as the German Chancellor and Japanese Prime Minister before him were also sent home. What are we doing? We have this amazing supply of fossil fuel energy that the world needs and is going to use for decades to come, whether we supply it or not, and we're just determined, or at least this government is determined, to leave it in the ground and not make it available, even when heads of state come here and are willing to make, I'm sure, a very profitable for us arrangement if we'll only provide them with what they need. They don't get it from us, they'll get it from somewhere else.
Well, and that's very true. And that's the problem. So to back up for a second, I do like what Ms. Rogers said, as much as I think there's a bit of a nefarious element, but it does get us to look at something that we don't see very often, which is the supply side, which is productivity. Now, we can, to the good listenership, we can measure productivity in many different ways, but really it's just economic output per hour worked. Or in other words, how efficient is our labor force? And by extension, how efficient are our businesses and our economy? And so I think this does dovetail well into what you're talking about, Roy, because we do have an excess supply of these staples and energy and natural gas and fuel, and yet we do decide to leave it into the ground. So as I always say, in the first chapter of every economic textbook, we talk about opportunity cost and comparative advantage. Canada has both of those things in our resource sector, and we choose not to use them. And now, just as an addition to what Ms. Rogers said, I said about output per labor, that seems pretty simple. So you think to yourself, well, how should we do that as an economy? I like the expression by Paul Krugman, who won the Nobel Prize. He said a few years ago, productivity isn't everything, but in the long run, it's almost everything. And so when you go back and look at how can you increase the supply side in an economy, if you have essentially punted on the demand side, you have to look at things like increased competition, skills development, smarter research and development. And then my favorite one, really the low-hanging fruit of the bunch, is to start eliminating the things that cause gross inefficiencies. And that's a fancy way of saying stop the insanity of bloating the public sector and maybe go back to the first three of those prescriptions and start to deal with the private sector. But your point is well taken. What's going on in the energy sector is symptomatic of all of the sectors. Competition, skills development, research and development funding, we're not going in that direction. We are kicking the same can down the road and then expecting a different result. And we know, Roy, that's just the definition of insanity.
Well, it isn't. Are we not also creating a negative mindset for the very people who should not be thinking negatively? And I'm talking about the young people in our society, the entrepreneurs of tomorrow, the career-seeking youth of tomorrow. They're here today. They're hearing all of this. We're certainly not doing them any favors, and we're not creating the kind of climate for them. I use the word climate advisedly. We're not creating the climate for them to really start thinking positively with all of this negative news that's swirling around them.
No, and in fact, there's a theory for that too. It's called the economics of self-fulfilling prophecies. The more that you tell the younger generation that they can work as hard as they want, but they're not going to come ahead in an economic sense, or at least be as well off as or better than their parents, well, they start to believe it. And there you go. And it starts the cycle again. And that's when people start to bail out on education and they start leaving the country and going to a country that they believe offers more in the way of opportunity. So to summarize our conversation, Roy, on this lovely Sunday, the demand side of our economy has been in trouble for a long time. Now the supply side is catching up in terms of being in trouble. And as I've said before, we can't win at home. We can't win on the road, Roy, and we're running out of places to play.
Yeah, that's so true. I really appreciate the Senior Deputy Governor of the Bank of Canada's statement, Carolyn Rogers, because it's such an effective visual. We've all seen these safety equipment behind glass. And on the glass, it reads, in case of emergency, break glass. Well, it's time to break the glass. There's no way to misinterpret that. Professor Cam, there's another story that I saw earlier in the week, and it really caught my attention. And that is, and I'm sure you can explain this to us, how this could be happening. The U.S. Federal Bank last week, I read, indicated it may be agreeable to accepting higher inflation and for longer periods of time, which runs counter to everything we've heard, at least from our bank, our central bank, over the last, well, 2 years. What are they doing?
You know what they're doing is they're moving into the modern era, Roy. There used to be a real school of thought that inflation and unemployment were trade-offs, and that effectively you could fight one, but you had to give up on the other. And they called that theory the Phillips curve. And it worked for odd periods of time in some countries. But what the United States has realized is that inflation at low, moderate, predictable levels is not a bad thing. And in fact, it is one of the results of a growing economy. I know that after the pandemic, what happened to the price level was absolutely criminal. Criminal to Canadians and Americans, for that matter, that are trying to just maintain their standard of living. But what's gone on in Canada, as we know, is this absolute holy war that we are going to bring down the inflation rate to 2% and the hell with whatever else has to give to get us there. And so what you're seeing is that whatever has to give now is both the demand side and the supply side of the economy. Our government's kind of given up on helping us increase our disposable income, and it's kind of given up on helping us increase our natural resource exports and the supply side. The United States, people ask me all the time, number one question, why are they doing better than us? It's because they've let go of old ideals and old beliefs that don't really work anymore. And it's time to stop blaming the pandemic, Roy. It's over and it's in the past. We have to deal now with the economic realities that inflation, again, positive, low, predictable, that is the sign of a growing, almost thriving economy. But our government sector doesn't want to abide by this. They have their beliefs and they are pigheaded and we're not going to move them. And so anybody sitting there waiting for the interest rate to fall is kidding themselves. Nothing is going to happen until this government magically gets to that 2%. Which I have to tell you, I don't see anytime soon. And I guess that's why it just makes me sad, because all of this is done on the backs of the taxpayers when there's just such a better way to go, but we don't want to see it, Roy.
Look, this government is going to be unmagically removed from power in the foreseeable future. I think we can be quite sure of that. Daryl Bricker from Ipsos told us yesterday, when I asked if there was any way that they could recover from the hole they're in now, he really doesn't see that as a possibility. But I can't let you go in the 2 minutes we have left. We've been talking about the carbon tax yesterday and today, particularly because this is the weekend leading up to the carbon tax rise tomorrow. So would you share with us, please, what your thoughts are on increasing the carbon tax? And then please share with us, in the time we have left, what happens to financially stressed Canadians now?
Well, my answer to that is consistent. I've been saying that they've got to put this carbon tax on the shelf for a long time. And of course, that's not because I don't believe in clean air. Everybody believes in clean air. Everybody believes in lots of wonderful things that I think that you can address when your economy is on a positive trajectory. But our economy, the Canadian economy, Roy, unlike the US, is right now pointed downward. And when an economy is pointed downward, all of its productive resources should be put into changing that arrow. And there are lots of ways to do it. We don't seem at all committed to any of them. But I could start really, really quickly that if I put that carbon tax, if I announce tonight that, you know, fellow Canadians, I've seen what's going on with our taxpayers. Far too many people are too close to insolvency, one paycheck away from being homeless, unable to feed and house their children. If you put a stop to it tonight, you automatically, by definition, put money into people's pockets. And to the few people walking around that I've ever bumped into that say, yes, but at a cost of clean air, I ask you, is the cost of cleaner air right now, knowing how little we pollute with respect to the entire world, is the cost of clean air worth putting people on the street? Because that's what you're doing, Roy. Economics at its core is about choices. And the choices this government is making right now is to bull ahead with a mission that is going to make so many people financially worse off. But they've chosen that. I would not, as you know. I would scrap this tax. I would scrap a few taxes and give people a fighting chance.
And we're minor contributors to the overall issue of emissions, this country is. But you said something a moment ago that I really twigged to. We used to say people are two paychecks away from being homeless. And you quite correctly said, and I've heard this and talked to experts about it, there are significant numbers of people, large numbers of people, who are literally now one missed paycheck away from being homeless. That's an issue that we must address. We cannot continue to live with growing tent cities. This is just absolutely repulsive that is going on in this wealthy country that we're allowing it to go on. Professor Cam, always great to have you join us. Time goes by way too quickly. Thanks for today.
Happy Easter, Roy. Stay healthy.
The agreement is in play, depending on the situation. Is that what I hear you saying?
It's always in play. Okay. It's going to be a constant question that we ask ourselves throughout the term of the agreement. We're going to constantly ask questions. Do we want to continue or not? Is the government doing what's needed or not? It's going to be an ongoing question.
The NDP have not taken the exit or the detour sign. They've stayed effectively politically married to the Liberal Party of Canada. That, of course, was Mr. Jagmeet Singh, leader of the New Democrats, who was on this program. Last time we talked to him was about a year ago. And that was the question then about this relationship of theirs. And will it survive? So I was thinking earlier in the week, so what are the chances? This is after, actually it was yesterday. I was thinking about it after our conversation with our good friend Daryl Bricker, the CEO of Ipsos Public Affairs. Wonderful polling firm, and I asked Daryl, what are the chances that the Liberals can recover from the miserable place they're in, 18 points behind the Conservatives, and the NDP even further behind, and Daryl said, not good, and it's because people have had enough. But
it is not unheard of for political parties to connect and then make it permanent. It happened in the 1980s in the UK when the Liberal Party of Britain hooked up with the SVP, what was the name of that party, actually? The Social Democrat Party, SDP. So the UK Liberal Party combined with the Social Democratic Party and created the Liberal Democrats. So knowing that they're so far behind in the polls, is it possible that Mr. Trudeau and Mr. Singh will try to make this relationship of theirs now permanent and form a permanent left-wing political party? 2003 in this country, the Progressive Conservative Party of Canada and the Canadian Alliance also formed a permanent union, and out of that came the Conservative Party of Canada. So it's not impossible, but how likely is it? And would you vote for such a party? Now, I'm going to open the phone lines in just a bit and ask you whether you might vote for such a hybrid party. If the Liberals and the New Democrats felt, well, the only way that we can stay in power is if we hook up and become one permanent party, would you find yourself potentially voting for, would you like the idea of voting for a combined Liberal Party and New Democratic Party? Let's talk to Mario Canseco. Mario is the president of Research Co. in British Columbia, a national polling firm. And I've known Mario for many years. And Research Co. polled Canadians on the question of a merged federal Liberal NDP party in October of last year. So, Mario, good to talk to you again. How are you?
It's my pleasure, Roy. Great to be here with you.
Yeah, so I didn't know that the polling had been done of Canadians, how they might feel about a merged Liberal and NDP party. What did you find out? What was the question you asked?
Well, we were very curious about this because in October of 2023, we were 2 years into the current term of the Liberal Party in a minority situation buttressed by the NDP. We thought it was a good opportunity to ask Canadians how they felt about the possibility of a merged Liberal and NDP coalition party in a way that would represent Canadians in the next election. And the reality is, it's not a game changer. You know, you see a lot of people who look at polls and who go, well, if you add the 20-something for the Liberals and the 20-something for the NDP, that gives us 40-something, and boom, you know, they would form the government. It's not as simple as that. And when we ask Canadians, would you vote for this party? Let's imagine that Justin Trudeau is leading the Liberal New Democratic Party in the next election. 36% of people say, I would vote for this party. But 42% told us that they would vote for the Conservatives. So part of the complexity here is, can you find somebody who can unite the left in a way, but also somebody who doesn't have the difficulties that we're seeing right now Justin Trudeau having as far as connecting with average Canadians?
Yeah. You can tell better than I, but I just don't think Mr. Trudeau has it any longer to be able to connect with average Canadians, Canadians who've struggled and suffered and are still struggling and suffering with the economy the way it is, their personal economies. And he's not an inspiring person. 2015, he was young, he was different. He had a different approach. And so people gravitated to him. But today, is that all gone now, Mario?
Well, I think there's an opportunity to steer policy. I think one of the advantages of incumbency when you're the prime minister is you can still try to figure out a way to make people pay attention to what you're doing. And, you know, they got a year to do this. I think one of the opportunities that they have is to actually have a pharmacare deal that works. But the problem when we ask Canadians about pharmacare is everybody loves the idea, but nobody knows exactly what's going to be included in the plan. And I think this is one of the issues that could make or break the chances of the Liberals and the NDP in the next election. You know, if the drug I require, if the medicine that I need is not going to be included in the pharmacare deal, I'm not going to like it. And right now we see Canadians having great expectations about what this program is going to entail, but we don't really know if that's going to be the case. And we also have fewer than 50% who trust the Liberal government to manage this. So it's a complexity on both sides. You know, you could have a list of things that are great and you might be having for free, but if you don't trust the government to manage the system, then you got a problem trying to sell it in a campaign.
Yeah, if it turns out to be anything like New Zealand, then it's not going to work very well, because New Zealand, with their national pharmacare program, out of 302 brand new medications, including medications for cancer, only 17 were made available through New Zealand's pharmacare program. A lot of that had to do with the fact that they weren't willing to pay the money that pharmaceutical companies required, and so the pharmaceutical companies just bypassed New Zealand. They're not a large enough market to really make a dent in pharmaceuticals, so they just bypassed them. We're not a massive market either. And if we are not willing to pay for the medications, the drugs, that prescription drugs that people need for serious illness, they're not going to suddenly turn around and say, well, okay, well, we'll give it to you on a special deal because that's what you're required. They won't do that.
No, and what we see when we ask Canadians about pharmacare is you have a significant age discrepancy. Generation X, you're right now, maybe you have young kids or aging parents. You're thinking about specific things that have to be included on this list. But we see the 18 to 34 demographic, which usually gravitates towards the Liberals and the NDP, they don't really rely on the healthcare system as much as older Canadians. And they're thinking, well, you know, maybe I want vitamins included in the pharmacare deal. Maybe I want nutritional supplements to be included in the pharmacare deal. I don't care about cholesterol-lowering medication or heart medication. So that is going to be part of the complexity here. People love the pharmacare idea. But once you get into the details, you might not be getting what you think you're getting.
Mm-hmm. But Mario, if we look at the political track record of Mr. Singh and Mr. Trudeau, particularly in since the last election, and the time that since their dating began politically, I'm trying to put it into context that will take us into an election campaign, you know, a marriage between two political parties. If we look at their performance and how they've attacked each other, or at least Mr. Singh has attacked Mr. Trudeau, it's very little credibility there as far as voters are concerned.
Well, I think part of the issue here is what happens in the next 6 months. If we start to see the NDP and the Liberals essentially tied within the margin of error in a situation where the NDP starts to grow in places like British Columbia, which could put in jeopardy some of the seats that the Liberals have, then it's not in the best interest of the NDP to continue with this deal. It might be better for them to try to position themselves as the official opposition. It happened before. It happened back in 2011. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the most difficult aspects of this is going to be what type of candidate can you attract? You know, there was a time when you looked at specific cities across the country and you saw a long list of councillors who had high hopes of running for the federal Liberals. I know that's the case in British Columbia. And then a year later, you don't have any of those people lining up to become federal candidates. So when you can't attract candidates, it's a sign that people don't want to go and represent a team that doesn't have a chance of winning the election.
Yeah, that's so true. Mario, great talking to you again. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
My pleasure, Roy. Anytime.
We'll talk to you again. Mario Canseco is the president of Research Co., and they are in British Columbia, national polling firm. And they did the polling on whether or not there would be major attraction for Canadians if the Liberals and the New Democrats were to form one party, which happened in the UK. It's happened in this country as recently as 2003, with the Progressive Conservative Party and the Canadian Alliance forming the Conservative Party of Canada. We're massively ahead now of both the Liberals and the New Democrats. All right, I have a question for you at 1-800-263-2428. 1-800-263-2428. Would you consider voting for a merged Liberal New Democratic Party so they could call themselves the Liberal Democrats? Would you vote for a merged Liberal New Democrat Party, Liberal Democrats, voting for them over the Conservative Party of Canada in the upcoming Canadian federal election, which will happen either late this year or most certainly next year? 1-800-263-2428. Joe in Calgary. How are you, Joe?
Can I say Happy Easter?
You sure can.
Okay. I wouldn't vote for either party, let alone if they were combined. But I did want to make a point.
Sure.
I wanted to bring to your attention an article in the National Post with our environment minister this weekend. I don't know if you had a chance to
read. Oh, his op-ed? Yeah, I read it.
Yeah, and my parents came here in the 1960s from Europe because they couldn't afford to buy a house there. They all had two or three jobs. They retired. They have got a nice pension. The house is paid for, and that's what I hope my children and my grandchildren aspire to. This business of you can't have a big house, you can't have a...
Oh, yeah, he went on about that, didn't he?
You can't have a yacht.
He went on about that. People with four-car garages, people have a boat, people have this and that and the other. There was definitely some metaphoric and anatomical envy going on.
Right, and it's just the environment minister reaching out to the NDP.
Yep.
Because I think the decision has already been made for them to merge.
Well, we'll see. Joe, thank you very much for the call from Calgary, 800-263-2428. Would you vote potentially for, let's call it the Liberal Democrats? And Glenn is in Maple Ridge, British Columbia. Glenn, what about you? You've got a provincial NDP government.
Hey, Roy. Yeah, hi. I've listened to you. I love your show.
Thank you.
And anyways, first time I've ever gotten through to you. But yeah, listen, in essence, we already have a LibDP government. And of course, if they amalgamated, I hope they get trashed. Maybe about a year ago, I was kind of hoping that the Conservatives would win with a minority government, ease them in. Now I want a trouncing. I want a trouncing of the Liberals, and I want a trouncing of the NDP. And the LibDP party is just what it is right now.
What did you call it? The LibDP?
LibDP. LibDP, Roy.
Oh, that's funny.
So I hope they get trounced. They can do whatever they want. They need to go, and it can't come soon enough. I'm like a kid at Christmas, right? All waiting for Christmas.
Glenn, thank you for calling. Glad you got through. Glenn in British Columbia. Candace in Edmonton calling us on the Roy Green Show. So there's a combined Liberal New Democrat federal party, Ken, and they're called the Liberal Democrats, and they're running in the next federal election. I'm just hypothesizing here. They're running in the next federal election, and they're opposing Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives. Do they have a chance of getting your vote?
Well, Roy, first of all, thanks for taking my call, Roy.
My pleasure.
This country can't afford another government from the left. If we look at history, this country went far, far in debt under Pierre Elliott Trudeau, and it took two decades to dig our way out of that hole. And fortunately for the country, Chrétien and Paul Martin kept Mulroney's cut. And eventually we dug our way out. But this time, Roy, it's going to take some real fiscal restraint to get out of this, And I'm not sure that some of our social programs like healthcare are going to survive.
And Ken, you're talking about a national population that is so financially stressed right now. That was, who said earlier, 40% of the younger generations of this country are not sleeping well at night because they're worried about their finances. So the financial underpinning for any kind of Paul Martin plan in the next few years is, I don't think it's there.
Well, I worry about what my grandkids are going to be facing. You know, I mean,
I hear you.
You know,
legitimate concern. Ken, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Leslie in Coquitlam, British Columbia. Hi, Leslie.
There is no way I will waste my vote on that Liberal NDP party. Period.
Okay. That's very emphatic.
I remember when Harper was in.
Yes, so do I.
And he said no wage increase. And he said, I make $157,000 a year as the prime minister.
Is that what it was?
More than enough money. Because we get all these other benefits for free.
I don't remember how much it was a number of years ago when Mr. Harper was in the Prime Minister's office.
$157,000 a year.
It
he was
sounds
making.
A little low, but okay. But you would not entertain even in the most vague terms.
Nope.
Okay.
Enough with Pierre Trudeau burying my grandkids, the whole bloody bit. And this one here has got his head on backwards, and so does Jagmeet Singh, as far as I'm concerned.
All right. Thank you, Leslie. And then there is, of course, Mr. Gupal. I read his op-ed in the National Post today. And Mr. Gupal just clearly, and I'd love to have him on this program, clearly Mr. Gupal does not have much use for people who have a little money and can look after themselves. And he likes the proletariat approach better.
So people should be able to enjoy heating their homes at a very low rate right now. But the federal carbon tax is going to go up to $4.09 a gigajoule. So you're going to be paying more than double the amount in the tax than you do for the base fuel. And when you look at our cold country, it's outrageous that we would be taxing people on that basic necessity of life. That's why I said it's immoral and they should stop it.
The Premier of Alberta, Danielle Smith, immoral carbon tax is immoral. And she said, we have a right, and we do. With all the riches we have a right to expect to be able to have low-cost energy and heat our own homes and take care of our families. We have that right. And I'm just going to say it again. There is a massive part of this world. So many nations are in need of what we have. They need oil. They need natural gas, LNG. And we just don't make it available to them. Again, the Prime Minister of Greece here last week, he was looking for a natural gas deal so Greece could act as a hub and distribute the LNG to its neighbor nations. Send them home. Nothing. Chancellor of Germany was here, about 18 months ago, looking for LNG. Sent them home. Nothing. Prime Minister of Japan was here shortly after the Chancellor of Germany, looking for natural gas. Sent them home. Nothing. Meanwhile, we're $1 trillion in debt, and people are losing sleep. Canadians are losing sleep over the fact that they have money woes, money concerns. We said it last hour. We said it before. The Royal Bank, used to be Royal Bank, RBG, 2023 Canadian Financial Well-Being Survey, which was conducted by Ipsos. 40% of Canadian adults reported losing sleep, worrying about money. 40%. And the younger Canadians particularly, as we told you, millennials, 27 to 42 years of age, 53% of millennials are having difficulty sleeping, which is the highest of any age cohort. It's just, well, it's outrageous. 59% of millennials and 53% of Gen Zers or Zetters reported having significantly strained relationships due to money woes. It's affecting millions and millions of people. And the carbon tax goes up tomorrow, and we will all feel it. We'll see it. Maybe you'll drive by the pump tomorrow because you filled up on the weekend. But eventually, you're going to have to pull in, and you're going to double gulp before you fill up your vehicle. I guarantee it. You will double gulp, and you'll go home, and around the dinner table, the conversation is going to be about, do you know how much it costs now? Dan McTagg is with us, at Gas Price Wizard, president of Canadians for Affordable Energy. Dan, it's good to have you with us, and particularly today, and I hope we can take a couple of calls in from our listeners in this segment that we're sharing.
It's great to be here, Roy. And of course, happy Easter to all you, your friends, and of course, our great listeners here. I'm really happy to be here to share with you today. Although I wish it was on different circumstances and we could be talking about a government that was trying to help people as opposed to making life difficult.
So here's the fundamental question I have for you. What happens to gasoline, diesel, home heating, food, clothing, other related costs tomorrow? What starts happening tomorrow as the carbon tax will go up again?
Yeah. So the carbon tax goes up 3.3 cents a liter for gasoline. It goes up 4.01 cents a liter for diesel. For propane, it goes up 2.32 cents a liter for natural gas. It goes up and based on basically on cubic meter. It goes up an additional 2.9 cents a cubic meter on its way to increasing 2.6 fold. In other words, it'll be 32 cents by the time all said and done in 2030. Of course, that comes at a time when we already can currently pay for gasoline 14.6131 cents a liter going to 17.61. So call it for what it is. In my province here in Ontario, that's 20 cents a liter on $1.60. If you're doing a quick math, that's 12.3% inflation. And if you look at diesel, Roy, going to 24 cents a liter, that's 14.8 cents a liter. No wonder experts are signaling that this is more than just a small little blip. Yes, minimizers out there, especially my colleagues in the Liberal Party, like to think of it as no big deal. But when you do the simple math, you realize the carbon tax now represents a whopping average 13, 14%. That, by the way, is six times higher than the prescribed guidance by the Bank of Canada that's trying to control inflation. So mess with affordability, mess with energy, and you wind up with an eternal problem of higher energy prices. And yes, the timing on this couldn't be worse. In the past, people didn't really pay attention to this, but we're now into an energy super cycle. Bottom line, you're heading into much higher prices as we head towards the summer, likely to rival what we saw in 2022.
What happens, you know, we can talk about Ontario because you and I both live in Ontario, but this program airs in other provinces across this country. What's happening, what's going to happen to the rest of the country? What's going to happen to other provinces? What will happen to the West? What happens to British Columbia? Well, they already have their own system, but so, what happens?
Yeah, Manitoba's up 4 cents a liter, 139.9 to 143.9. Saskatchewan will go from $1.54 to $1.57. Alberta, there is also the restoration of part of the tax there, 4 cents a liter. So it's going up net 7 cents a liter to $1.62. Alberta will have the same price as Ontario. If you're looking at British Columbia, up 4 cents a liter when Vancouver's up four as well. Vancouver, by this time tomorrow, will be 206.9, and some gas stations will be offering it to 2.08.9. Quebec has its own cap and trade. The price is hidden, but I can tell you what it is because it's right there as an energy trader. It's 12.17 cents a liter for gasoline. It's not going up for another couple of months, but it's now 5.5 cents a liter less the rest of the country. Atlantic Canada will see likely the changes on Thursday and Friday when they have their regulated price changes.
And the carbon tax is really a hub, is it not, for a additional taxation, GST is added, as well as other federal regulations affecting the carbon tax. It's not just the few cents per liter that you've told us about, Dan.
Yeah,
this is the hub, and it's the spokes spread outward.
Yeah, it is, and it's really the thin edge of the wedge because after this comes the second carbon tax. Now it's applied in Atlantic Canada and British Columbia, which is why you pay over $2 a liter in Vancouver for gasoline, because they have a hidden 17-cent low-carbon fuel standard, which is what Trudeau has imposed on the rest of the country. For now, refiners in Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and Ontario and Quebec have held back and said, no, we're going to just pour in more ethanol, much of it U.S.-made, into the content to make it 15%. Then, on January 1st, well, that's when we start adding fully another 17 cents. So, Roy, let me just put this in very simple perspective. If I'm looking at gasoline, by the time it's said and done in 72 months, we're going to be paying with tax about 42 cents a liter for the first carbon tax, another 17 to 20 cents a liter for the second carbon tax. So that gives you roughly about 62, 63 cents a liter just in carbon taxes alone. And here, I'm not talking about the weakness of the Canadian dollar, which adds another 25 cents a liter because we love to block pipelines in this country.
Yeah. Let me ask our callers, our listeners, if you want to become callers, 1-800-263-2428, 1-800-263-2428 is the number. Do you have a question for Mr. McTagg? Is there a point you want to make about what's happening to prices, to energy costs, to the price of gasoline? And if you're a trucker, what's going to happen with the diesel? 1-800-263-2428. If you have a question for Dan McTagg, give us a call. Dieter in Winnipeg. Hey, Dieter, thanks for calling. Go ahead, please.
I'm calling, a long-time listener.
Thank you.
You got me so fired up with this thing today, and especially what you were talking about before. I don't know what happened to this country. We used to have trade people here. We used to have productivity. And now we're asking people to pay a huge amount of money in a country where we don't really have an infrastructure to get people around unless they're driving. In Winnipeg, our transit system is horrible. No one's been talking about upgrading anything into the future. It's all patchwork. There's no more long-term planning on how we get out of this mess. It's stupid.
Dan, go ahead, please. Talk to Dieter.
Well, Dieter's right. I mean, there isn't a lot going for the country right now because we've turned off everything. And what we have focused our attention on are things that the rest of the world's already building, China in particular. And what's critical, what's really critical in all this, is to understand full well that when you have a country that is borrowing, as you've mentioned, Roy, over $1 trillion, it gets to the point where, if we're going to kill the very things that make our economy run and people have an opportunity to make ends meet, then you're going to wind up in a far worse position. I think that's why so many people are calling in and so many people are frustrated that they can't do anything about a government that seems to be deliberately driving ship of state over a cliff.
Dieter, a final comment from you. You're the one who's going to be out there tomorrow, and you'll see the results of the carbon tax increase on the boards outside the gas stations.
It's very frustrating. So I'm a commercial pilot by trade. I see how people aren't going to be able to afford to get their pilot's licenses. We need pilots. I fly for search and rescue. That's going to drive up our costs. I have to drive everywhere because I can't get a bus where I live. I just think I'm very tired of people continually putting out fires at the problems they've caused and not trying to find resolutions in the future. And that might hurt us all in the short term, but put a bloody plan together, folks.
Thank you, Dieter, for calling, and thanks for what you do. Flying search and rescue is incredibly important. Thanks for that.
Thank you for what you do. That's incredibly important.
I appreciate that. Dieter in Winnipeg. Dan, we keep hearing about the rebate, and we keep hearing Mr. Trudeau and Mr. Guilbeault and the supporters of the carbon tax saying that the Parliamentary Budget Officer has said that everybody's going to get more money back than they put in, or 80% of the population. We've had Yves Giroux on this program many times. He's a good friend of this program. And just about 3 weeks ago, he told us that he's standing by what he said, and that is that the middle class, when they get to 2030 and reach their optimal number they're looking for 2030 for the carbon tax, the middle class is going to lose money. Everybody, essentially, except for those at the lowest segment of the socioeconomic ladder. Everyone else is going to cost money, even though the supporters of the carbon tax run around telling everyone, you're going to get more money back than you pay. It just doesn't make any sense. Look, it takes us back to Brad Wall, when he was the Premier of Saskatchewan, looking at Trudeau and saying, what's the point? You're going to take money away from my farmers in the tax, this carbon tax. Then you're going to give it to me, and I'm supposed to give it back to them. What's the point?
You have to wonder why a party that has clearly understood, and the polls I think are demonstrating this in universal ways, that they are losing support because people aren't upset with them necessarily, not upset with Trudeau. They can't afford these people. And to now suggest when people are trying to make ends meet that somehow they're ahead isn't just mathematically ridiculous. It's realistically ignorant. And I've never seen it, which really goes back, Roy, to what I've mentioned many times in the past. These people don't do real. They don't understand what ordinary people have to go through. They don't have a long-term objective. And what objective they have is to somehow try to get bragging rights when they go to international forum every year with ever-increasing numbers of people using fossil fuels to get there, to tell people that we ought to punish ourselves even more. And yet they continue to lose support, faith, and trust. The government itself is nothing more than a cult clinging to power. And unfortunately, for Canadians in 2021 who didn't think a big deal of voting for these guys for a second, third time, I think there's now significant buyer's remorse, and so there should be.
Well, they're 18 points back of the Conservatives. That's the Liberals, and the NDP a little behind the Liberals. Chris is in Edmonton. Good question. Chris, go ahead, please.
Yes, my question very simply is, what's the alternative, Dan, to a carbon tax? Because they like to tout their experts saying, this is what the experts have told us is the best way to change behavior. So my question is, what's the alternative? I, you know, personally, I don't know how there can't be a business case for liquefied natural gas to China and India, but, you know, that's what our prime minister said. So.
Okay, hold on, Chris. Dan, I have about 35 seconds for the answer. Go ahead, please.
They're in no position to frame that kind of question. It's based on fundamental dishonesty. And, of course, ask them the simple question, who pays them? How are they funded? And if they weren't such alarmists, would they get funded at all? Look, I'm not going to go down the science rabbit hole with them. They know full well that this isn't about 0.04%, of which mankind is responsible for 3%, of which Canada is 1.5%. It's so infinitesimally small. We're talking about a speck of dust on a porch, and we want to wreck the whole house.
It's good. It's a question I hear a lot. Chris, thank you very much for the call. I hear that a lot. So if not the carbon tax, then what? And I always say, well, why does there have to be? Then what? And you have just pointed out that there does not have to be a then what. Dan, always great. Thank you so much for the time today. Thanks.
Good, my friend. Thanks for having me. Bye, Roy.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you want to hear more, subscribe to The Roy Green Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorites. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and tell a friend. I'm Roy Green. Have a great weekend.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.